I'm interested in how we go about assessing drug safety. So I'm particularly interested in the clinical use of drugs and the kind of decisions that regulators, clinicians and patients have to make in order so that they can use medicines wisely. So I think we've got a relatively clear standard of evidence for assessing drug benefits. Right? When it comes to harm, things are not nearly so clear. So I'm going to start with my key claims. I'm then going to talk a little bit about the kind of advice that's available for assessing drug safety. And I'm going to spend most of my time working through a case study that I hope illustrates the main points I want to make, the conclusions I make at the start here. And that's a case study looking at clopidogrel and proton pump inhibitors. So where I'm heading, right? So it's my suggestion that our current approach to drug safety is muddled. And by muddled, I mean that there's a lot of good advice out there, but there's also a lot of bad advice. And the problem with the bad advice isn't so much that it's just straight out wrong, it's that we're not nearly careful enough about the kind of context in which we have to employ that advice. So the result is we've got this mixture of epistemological approaches and methodological criteria that we employ inconsistently and at times inappropriately. So that's claim one, and that's I want to demonstrate that through the case. My second claim is that we've got a bunch of recent work in philosophy of science and philosophy of medicine that can help resolve this muddle. Right, so I'm going to introduce the philosophical toolkit and use that to come up with some solutions. The essential solutions I want to suggest that come from this philosophical toolkit is that we move away from method-focused approaches. What we do instead is focus on the argument that's licensed by the data as opposed to the method that produced the data. Another component of this that I want to suggest is, so instead of taking this method-focused approach to amalgamating evidence, I want to take an explicitly causal approach to amalgamating evidence. So I'm going to spend the rest of the talk trying to articulate this. So the philosophical toolkit. So there's relatively little sustained philosophical attention on assessing drug safety. The kind of work I'd like to contribute to is the work of Jan Vandenbroek, an epidemiologist that's done a lot of work in assessing drug harms and particularly focuses on observational data. I'd also like to contribute to some of the work done by one of our colleagues, Barbara Ossimani, who's got a recent project, is working through a project looking at the epistemic challenges of assessing drug safety. The philosophical toolkit I want to employ, the first part of this toolkit is Julian Rice's recent paper, Pragmatist Theory of Evidence. I think this paper provides a really nice backdrop to many of the things I want to say. So in this paper, Julian introduces and gives a broad outline of the experimentalist paradigm, so and within which methods are seen as inherently reliable and epistemically basic. And he spends the rest of the paper articulating a pragmatist alternative. So he provides an account of support and an account of warrant. So my first claim is that the framework that Julian articulates, the eliminativist hypothetico-contextualist framework, is actually well describes the best of clinical drug safety science. By that I mean that when you read the primary literature, what you see scientists and clinicians doing is identifying hypotheses, systematically offering alternatives and working through those alternative hypotheses using standard methodological techniques and context-specific knowledge. Right, so that's what we see in the best of things. But I also want to suggest that a muddle arises as we try to amalgamate the different evidence that comes out of the primary literature. And I think that a nice way to see or diagnose some of that muddle is this kind of both the experimentalists and the pragmatists being employed, but often implicitly, right? So they end up muddled together and things get confusing. So again, I'm going to try to illustrate this with a case. Also in the philosophical toolkit is Nancy Cartwright's work on evidence-based policy, and in particular her reminder that evidence issues from an argument. Evidence for hypothesis issues from an argument, it doesn't issue from a method. Right? The method might be important for certain premises in the argument, but what we should be watching is the argument, not the method. Related work, Frederica Russo and John Williamson and their epistemic account of causality, and in particular their suggestion that often in biomedicine, we're trying to establish a singular causal claim. We're interested in a single causal claim, But to establish that single causal claim, we appeal to evidence of different types, specifically evidence of mechanisms and evidence of difference making. And I suggest that this is a helpful way to think through evidence amalgamation, and it's better than the experimentalist approach. Okay, so let me back up just a little bit and talk a little bit about the advice that's out there for assessing drug safety. I'm going to focus on evidence-based medicine. The reason I focus on that, and when I say evidence-based medicine, I mean the broad version of evidence-based medicine. And the reason I focus on that is that it's dominant, but it's not the only game in town. There's a whole bunch of other advice we have out there for assessing drug safety. One big strand of it is found in the pharmacoepidemiology literature. So this uses epidemiological approaches to detect and assess drug safety. We've also got a range of other ones. We've got advice out there for detecting whether an individual patient is likely to have suffered an adverse effect from an individual drug, much like Austin Bradford Hill's criteria. We've also got a range of methods that we use in drug development to identify adverse effects early so that we don't continue. So I'm going to focus on evidence-based medicine, but it's not the only game in town. The reason I'm going to focus on evidence-based medicine is that its big role comes in... I'm getting ahead of myself. Its big role comes in when we're amalgamating evidence. So when I talk about the case, I want to suggest that there's something that goes wrong in the amalgamation phase, and some really important stuff drops out. The argument for what's going on. Okay, so let me back up a little bit and say a little bit more about evidence-based medicine. So this is the Oxford Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine levels for harms. So Oxford Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine puts forward different levels for different decisions. Many of us have talked about the benefits ones most. Here's the one for harms. What you might notice if you know the benefits one really well, is that on the harms one, there's more recognition that observational data can play a more important role. It gets listed higher up. So that's an important difference. But I want to focus on the similarities, right? So focus on the methods. Systematic reviews of rigorous methods go up higher. The mechanism-based reasoning still goes down the bottom, right? So there's a range of ways that you can interpret levels such as this. Here's two broad ways. One way is within the experimentalist paradigm that Julie discussed, and that's that these just are seen as basic. And if you have evidence from the higher one, you should use that for your decisions rather than evidence down the lower one. Another way to see this is that something much more complicated is actually happening. What justifies this is that, okay, there's some kind of pragmatist theory that falls in the background, but what this sits on top of is a bunch of heuristics for making decisions. So we've got more complicated account that sort of tells us the story, and this is the heuristics that we base it on. You can find both of those kind of accounts in the literature. For me, it doesn't matter which one you want to go for. Both are problematic because they both coexist, right? Whichever one you go for, when we talk through the case, whether you want to call it the experimentalist paradigm being enforced or the heuristic, they both got a problem, right? Cool, and now we're onto the case. So the case is focused on the drug interaction between clopidogrel and proton pump inhibitors. Clopidogrel is an antiplatelet drug. It's used to treat and prevent acute coronary syndromes. The way to think about acute coronary syndromes is that they're heart attacks or near heart attacks. The landmark study for clopidogrel is the CURE study. And what they demonstrated in the CURE study is that if you've got patients that have acute coronary syndrome and you give them clopidogrel plus aspirin, they have less cardiac events than patients that just have aspirin alone. The important things to keep in mind about the CURE study is that, first, the benefits of clopidogrel are modest, right? The easiest way to see that is that we needed to enroll 12,000 patients to detect those benefits. The next thing to say is that there's a cost. So we get a benefit, but there's a cost. And what the cost is, in particular, is that it increases bleeding. One of the ways we can mitigate some of that risk of bleeding is by co-administering proton pump inhibitors. What proton pump inhibitors do quite well is prevent gastric ulcers and bleeding from gastric ulcers. The bottom line of this part of the story is that it's really common to see these three drugs together, aspirin, clopidogrel, and proton pump inhibitors. If you show me towards the cardiology ward on the local hospital, we'll bump into somebody on these three drugs pretty quickly. Or something similar to these three drugs. So a little bit more detail about the drugs. So clopidogrel is a prodrug. it's activated by the body. The enzyme that activates clopidogrel is called cytochrome P450-2C19. The label's not important, but what it does is. And the reason it's important is for two reasons. First of all, the function of 2C19 is genetically determined. We all vary slightly in our function of 2C19. Some of us have a loss of function LL, which means that we get no action out of 2C19. For those people, if you give them clopidogrel, they'll get no benefits out of the clopidogrel. The second thing that's important about the 2C19 is that the proton pump inhibitors are metabolized via 2C19. So they do so as a class. I'm only going to talk about two proton pump inhibitors in the space of the talk. One's omeprazole, the other one's pantoprazole. Both are pretty common. Omeprazole is extensively metabolized through 2C19, pantoprazole hardly at all. So these are opposite ends of the spectrum. So now you've got the theoretical background for the drug interaction. Essentially what happens is you give omeprazole with your clopidogrel, they're both competing for 2C19 action. Because they're competing, your clopidogrel doesn't get activated, you don't get the effect, you don't get the benefits of clopidogrel. Right? That's the theoretical basis for the interaction. And now I want to talk about the evidence. And when I talk about the evidence, I'm going to talk about the mechanism, and then talk about the difference-making evidence. And then I'm going to talk about how that evidence gets amalgamated, right? That's where my main focus is. So the mechanistic evidence. People were worried about the adverse effects, so they went looking to see whether it was happening. Notice that this is a couple of years after cure. These are millions of people worldwide using these combinations of drugs at this stage. The Gillard paper, what they did is they got patients that were getting acute coronary stents. These people were all taking clopidogrel, and they randomized these patients to get omeprazole or placebo, and then they collected data on their platelet function. What they found was that the patients that they gave omeprazole to, clopidogrel didn't work as well for them. Right? The FDA released a warning that led the sponsor to start looking for more data to see if we can understand this interaction. The synopsis of what the sponsor came up with is in the Angiolillo paper, and what they found was that they compared omeprazole and pantoprazole, and the main findings are these, right? They looked at healthy volunteers. If you give omeprazole with clopidogrel, two things happen. You get less active metabolite when we measure the active metabolite in your blood system, and you get less effect from clopidogrel on your platelets. You give pantoprazole, and you hardly see any difference. Clopidogrel just works as normal. Okay, this is mechanistic information. The reason it gets called mechanistic information is for a couple of different reasons. Hopefully you can see you could easily label this difference-making evidence, right? You may want to label it difference-making evidence. In the medical literature, this gets called mechanistic evidence because it's giving us evidence for that mechanism. And it's kind of a definition of exclusion. It's not difference-making because they're not getting the right difference, right? The right difference that people are looking for, does this interaction cause a difference in heart attacks? Right? So mechanism versus difference-making is somewhat arbitrary. I'm just noting that as we go along. So we've got this evidence, and now the medical world is trying to say, okay, is this clinically important? This sure seems important. We've got some good evidence here that this interaction is important. Does it come out in practice? Everyone that's writing about this is saying, oh, what we really need is a large-scale randomized controlled trial that randomizes people to omeprazole versus placebo in people that get clopidogrel. It so happened that a version of that trial, or something like that trial, actually happened. It's the Cogent trial. The reason they set up this trial is important. The reason was to demonstrate that if you give omeprazole, you reduce the GI upset. But they also collected the data on the cardiovascular events. The outcome of the trial was, yes, you give omeprazole with the clopidogrel, those patients get less stomach ulcers and stomach bleeding. You look at the cardiac stuff, and you see no effect on the cardiovascular events. Sounds like good news, right? The problem is Cogent was never powered to detect the difference in cardiovascular events. And it isn't powered to detect the difference in cardiovascular events. I do my back-of-the-envelope power calculation, and Cogent's got about 40% power to find that difference. If you wanted to power Cogent so that it would reliably detect the kind of difference we're looking at, so remember that the benefits of clopidogrel are modest. If we think they're going to be attenuated, we're looking for an even smaller effect. So you need something about the size of cure, which is 12,000 or more, right? And you don't have that. So let's go and look at further difference-making evidence. Non-randomized evidence, the observational studies. And these are kind of complicated, some are within RCTs. We've got an awful lot of antiplatelet trials, and they can go back to these old antiplatelet trials and have a look at patients that were taking PPIs or not taking PPIs. And we've also got registry data. The main problem with these are twofold. The first problem is that when they look at the PPIs, none of them are big enough to be able to differentiate the different PPIs. So you're either on a PPI or you're not. Remember, the hypothesis that we're chasing here is that certain PPIs will be bad on this interaction, other PPIs aren't. The second problem is that we've got an independent link between PPI use. Sorry, PPI use is proton pump inhibitors. I apologise for the slip into acronyms, but I'm going to continue it. PPI use is independently linked to cardiovascular events. The sicker you are, the older you are, the more likely you to have high risk of stomach problems, the more likely you have problems of stomach problems, the more likely you've got a bunch of other stuff going on. So we've got this confounding problem in all the observational data. And this isn't like one of those general things about observational data that we need to worry about confounders. That's true, right? This is a specific confounder that when you look for it, you see it. People, whether they take clopidogrel or not, if they happen to be taking a PPI, they're more likely to have a heart attack. So it's pretty hard to interpret this data. The best of them is this Rassen. They used high-density propensity scores to match the people on multiple variables. And what they find is an increased risk that's tiptoes statistical significance that doesn't reach it. Okay, that's all the primary data. My interpretation of this is really clear mechanism stuff. When you come to the difference-making stuff, we've got absence of evidence rather than evidence of absence. Right? If you're going to make a call, you might make a call towards the, looks like we've got a signal here, right? It'd be nice to get more data. We might never get more data, but there's something, it looks plausible there's something going on here, but, you know, you can't kind of stab it with a stick. Okay, so now we get onto the way that this evidence gets amalgamated, right? And what I kind of want to illustrate is the way it gets amalgamated is very method-focused. There's a big focus on the RCT data. There's a big focus on the higher quality observational data. What we see is this kind of gradual leaking out of the main hypothesis that we're trying to test, which is, does omeprazole and clopidogrel cause a problem? So if you have a look, systematic reviewers make a bunch of claims about, well, look, you know, if we want to get to this complex thing, we've really got to stratify it according to study design. That's going to be too small. That's a forest plot. But here's what they do. They actually observe a statistically significant increase in risk when you put it all together. The way they interpret this data is to say, well, we can't trust the observational data. And you can't for the reasons I just talked about. We can't trust the even better observational data because we can't for the reasons we just talked about. So they just focus on this and they see that that's crossing the line. So they say, well, okay, we can just... Basically, they discount everything. They don't focus on the argument. They just say, look, these are the highest quality ones. We don't see a statistically significant effect here. Therefore, we suggest there's no effect. I can give you quote after quote within the several systematic reviews that have been conducted that kind of do the similar things. Right? You know, so point to the higher quality studies, note that they don't have an effect, and then say, well, it seems to be safe. Right? These guys know power as well as we do, but it's being discounted when we amalgamate the evidence. Again, just more quotes. I'm kind of wrapping it up now. You know, what we really need is an RCT, but we don't have it. This mechanistic stuff, you can't trust that mechanistic stuff, and it's contradicted by the available clinical evidence. That's just demonstrably false, right? So again, what I'm trying to illustrate is when we amalgamate the evidence, we start focusing on the methods, the argument starts to fall out. When we look at professional guidance, this is the Australian Medicine's Handbook. It's like the British National Formulary, for those that know it. So the kind of advice it gives is contradictory, right? So it gives good advice about the mechanism, and then straight underneath it, evidence is conflicting, true. However, recent systematic review concluded that high quality evidence does not support a clinical effect from any of any interaction.
That just undermines it, right? So what happens in practice? People go, well, it's a nice interaction to know about, but it doesn't matter. Again, I'm pointing to this as an example of what's going wrong here is going wrong in the evidence amalgamation. This is method focused. What's fallen out is the argument. For what it's worth, the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, of all the regulatory bodies, I think actually gets it closer. They got it wrong first, but they issued a second one, and it's much closer. But I was going to talk more about some of the regulatory advice, but I appreciate it. I'd run out of time. So coming back to my client, right? I think the primary data is the primary studies. When you look at the primary literature, I think that's really well described by the kind of pragmatist framework that Julian Rice puts forward. It's when you come to the secondary data and the way that they amalgamate the evidence that things go awry. And that the way they go awry suggests that there's too much focus on the method. What we need is a better focus on the argument rather than the method, and we need an explicitly causal approach to evidence amalgamation rather than banging the methods together. Thank you. No. No. And I'd be skeptical of a method that would be able to put this into numbers nicely, right? I actually think a better method would be this kind of, like, follow the argument all the way through, right? So, I grab that hypothesis. The hypothesis is that if you take omeprazole with clopidogrel, you get less effects, and that's clinically important. Right, so we got to the point of it's physiologically important. We've shown that pretty well. The next question is: is it clinically important? When we amalgamate the evidence, I think the strategy for amalgamating the evidence has to be on the argument and premises. And okay, here's our uncertainty about a bunch of stuff. I have doubts that we could just not neatly put it into any kind of confidence interval or Bayesian probability, if that's the answer.
So I would want to unpack the last two claims in the following sense, because for Julian Rice, causation is often inference, and he adopts this inferentialist view of causation in which everything would count as causation, even the proper context features as a cause. So what would you mean by the last two claims here? I mean, what respect you would need an explicitly causal approach to evidence amalgamation, because in the context of Rice's paper, it would be something like arguing, giving back and forth reasons. How this would get us out of the conundrum that you have described in the presentation?
How would it get us out of the conundrum?
Yeah.
So I take our current approach to evidence amalgamation is something messy that's related to the hierarchy of evidence. At the moment we do a bunch of stuff, but at the end of the day, when the push comes to shove and we've got to make these tough decisions and there's always going to be uncertainty, that's the other part about harms, right? That's, people are making a decision either way. And you have to make it in an uncertain environment. So the current method I'd suggest is something along the line, people are rating their methods and then making their decisions based on the highest ranked method. I'm trying to say that that's a bad way to evidence amalgamate here. The way you need to do it is causally explicit. The way that gets spelt out, I think, is very nice in Julian's paper. I'm trying to say yes, please.
My immediate objection is that everybody would count as causal, given the proper context.
Okay.
And therefore, they can already describe their claims in causal terms in a way that would give you exactly where you were.
Yeah.
In the beginning.
Okay. So I'm going to give more detail about rather than that, do this.
This may be an unfair question. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about how your argument might relate to Sean's talk. Because, I guess there are two ways of taking what you said. One way is, look, this is a bad way of getting the evidence amalgamated. It's epistemically bad. But there's an alternative way, which might say, you know what, strictly, they're right. The RCTs are the best evidence, etc., etc., etc. It's just that there's a value issue here. That when we're concerned about harms, maybe weaker evidence would license an inference because costs of a false or a false negative are so high. So I was wondering
some of Barbara Osmani's stuff gets towards the we got to change our standards. I don't think we have to change our standards. We've got to shoot for the highest standard possible. If we've got the perfect RCT, and like if Cogent was big enough, I'm happy to back it. It would be better than these observational studies because they've got this confounding. So let's keep our standards the same, but let's not. But we need to make a decision, even when we're not going to meet those standards. If that kind of gets somewhere, right? We need to do the best we can. So how do we do the best we can? One way is to say, look, we've just got nothing here. The other way to say is, look, well, if you follow these arguments, this is. It's like two different methods to arrive at the decision that we're going to make.
Yeah, I have a quick question in regard to arguments versus methods. Even if you take your arguments, then there are several types of arguments, good and bad arguments. So
yep.
Could you say anything more about that?
Yeah. So I guess we've got to get onto detail about. I don't have a lot to say, right? So I'm kind of relying on the eliminativist hypothetico-contextualist account, right? And that seems to me a really nice description of what's happening when things are done well. I think it's the kind of thing that they won't know the label, right? But you describe the kind of practices. Like I think if you looked at the best of the primary literature, they're doing exactly that. It can be described very closely in that. So that's the account I want to sort of go with. And to say to practitioners, look, here you're doing this, and then for reasons that are unclear, these important premises have fallen away. You're no longer focusing on these. Why have you switched paradigms in the way you're thinking? Why don't we stick with this and hopefully get somewhere else?
Yeah. I don't see how that changes what you're saying, because although they want to value mechanisms more, at the end of the day, they're still going to see the prior to.
Yeah. So I guess I'm just using that basic idea that we shouldn't get so fussed about the different types of causality happening. And in particular, when we're looking at a causal claim, we need to be looking at both the mechanism and the difference making. I don't really want to use it any more than that. I'm sure I could use a whole bunch of different causal accounts to do a similar thing.